This is a Collider.com audio interview.
Oh, the hot seat.
No pressure.
Nope.
Yeah, Amy warmed up for you, so.
Okay, perfect. Well done. Sorry, I got held up. Right, I'm here.
So I guess I wanted to start off by talking about the editing process and you. You're known for improvising, for changing, having the script to go off of. Mm-hmm. How much of the film did you discover or find in the editing process? Could you talk about the post-production and what went in?
Well, you sort of can't talk about the post-production unless you talk about what comes first, you know?
Sure.
I mean, listen, there's a... All directors make films in individual ways, you know? But the classical kind of view of filmmaking is that you have a script and it's very linear. You know, there's a script, then you go and shoot the script, then you cut that, and then that's the end of the film. And that's never really been how I've seen it. I always try and bring screenplay, shooting and editing into a sort of symbiotic, as close into alignment as you possibly can get them, consistent obviously with the resources that you've got and the time you've got available. Because it's only, seems to me, that way that you can get what I think is the heart of the filmmaking process, which is the relationship between structure, you know, rigidity, form, whatever you want to call it, and freedom, improvisation, the moment, whatever. And those two qualities, you have to have both. You can't have one without the other, or at least I don't think you can, okay? And I think what people sort of, when people talk about my style, I think what they're talking about, I could be wrong, is two very different and quite extreme ends of that process married together. So I think when you think of my films, I think, hopefully, you think of an extreme sort of real unfolding, real time, you know, performed feeling, semi-improvised, you know what I mean? All that very real feeling mixed with very driving and direct, clear and concise and detailed storytelling. So the things are moving with great clarity, but feeling that they're unfolding as if just captured, right? Well, the reason that I get that, if I do, I mean, I'm just telling you, you know what I mean? When it works, which not always it does, of course, is because I challenge that linear model and try and bring them into close alignment. So what does that mean in practice? And this is a way of answering your question. It means you've got to have a screenplay going in. You know, most of the films that I've made in my life, I've written, not all, but most, I would say. But this one Brian wrote. But in any case, you know, we were a team in effect. You're trying to create a screenplay, and your screenplay is there to give you structure, rigidity, situational awareness, who the characters are, what do they want, what's the shape of the thing, how's it going to go, you know. Those are always the first questions I ask, rather than what's the dialogue going to be. That's a different issue, right? Now, obviously, there is dialogue in a screenplay, and very good dialogue at that, but you're looking to get to that solid foundation of structural confidence so that when you go shooting, you can then open that screenplay up to your actors and make it a very biddable free process, but from a place of where you know where you are. So you're coming into a scene knowing what you're doing and this is what the character are and all that. Then I like to make it very, very free. And sometimes I'll make it freer even than the screenplay is, so that I can deny a piece of information to the actor so they really are forced to be in the moment, okay? Sometimes if that doesn't work, I might reintroduce the script. So you can be anyone, but essentially you're trying to free the thing up, right? So you've had this collision between structure and freedom. Then you get into the cutting room and, you know, Chris Rouse, who cuts all my films, and I will then impose an extreme degree of rigidity at that point, and very, very fast try to. so that we can then offer that back to the filming process straight away, if resources will allow. So let me give you a for instance for that. If you take, for instance, that long sequence that runs from the Miller being at the soccer field digging, and Freddie turns up, and then he comes and tells Miller, and Miller goes, you know, gets the guys, and they go over and they hit the house, and then they go in and they get Sayid, and then they drag him back to the soccer field, put him against the wall. There's a scene, the special forces turn up, there's a scene between Miller and Briggs. There's a big fight, and then there's a fight between Miller and Briggs. Then, you know, then Freddie runs off in the alley and they chase him, and it ends up with the scene with Freddie, right? That whole section, which must be, I don't know, 15 minutes of screen time, Brian wrote that, and pretty much we shot that. I mean, structurally, it's absolutely what we shot, you know. Some of the dialogue, well, a lot of the dialogue was improvised, but actually it bears a very, very close relationship to what was written. Along the way, as we were shooting, let's say, for instance, I'll use that as an example, we were in that location, I think, for about 12 days, doing all those various pieces, you know, the general's meeting, the this, that. So within that 12 days, you've got freedom to schedule as you want. You can't stay more than 12 days, but you've got that to play with, right? Well, I remember that our first day, we'd built in rehearsal time at the end of a shooting day, because it was Jason Isaac's first day. So we were going to shoot, I can't remember what it was, we were going to shoot till 3 o'clock, and then from 3 to 7 we were going to rehearse. So we'd be ready the next day to then shoot the helicopter arrival, okay? That's right. And one of the reasons we had a rehearsal day is because we needed to rehearse without cameras, just the whole issue of the helicopters getting in, how those guys were going to get out, and all of that. And Jason had literally just arrived, it was his first fitting, et cetera, et cetera. I said to Jason, listen, why don't we just shoot this? Because we're going to be here anyway. We're all here. It's not costing us anything to shoot it. So why don't we just shoot it? We might get something out of it. It's a rehearsal. If we don't get anything out of it, we haven't lost anything, right? We did that. And it became very apparent during that and it was Jason's idea, that actually he was stopping to talk to Miller when he came off the helicopter. And in fact, he shouldn't. He should walk straight past the guy and just keep on going and completely ignore him, which is what we did. So we then came back the next morning and shot that, which was our shooting day. But we'd found it through shooting, you know. I don't think you'd have quite got that in rehearsal quite as, because there's something about the intensity of actually turning it over that makes you find it, right? So that's an area of the film that was very close. There were other areas where the scene with Amy and Matt in the hotel room, where we had a couple of goes at that in various different ways, because we always knew there needed to be a scene between the two of them, and we had various ones written, but I was never very comfortable with it. So I always tried to encourage them both to kind of perform that situation. You know, you knew, each character knew where they were in terms of what they knew and what they were trying to get, you know. And in the end, what we ended up with was a kind of a marriage between the two, really. So then you sort of look at another area, which would say be the big end action sequence. Well, when you're shooting action, you've got to kind of, there's no point writing lots of dialogue in an action sequence. You do, and it's very great care is taken, because you need to be very careful about you're conveying certain pieces of information. You know what I mean? But it's a roadmap. That's what a screenplay is. Sometimes it's an incredibly detailed dialogue-based roadmap. Sometimes it's a roadmap to the shooting of it to enable the actors to then go off and be able to seize this and run with it. Sometimes it's a first go at the road, but actually when you really get there, you realise that the road shouldn't run like this, it should actually run like this, and you find that through performance. Sometimes you do both and you get it all in the cut, and we go, actually, if we could find that piece, the road would actually go through the middle. You know, that's filmmaking. It's a process of organically building your way to a goal that you see clearly in the distance, or dimly in the distance, through the terrain that you actually traverse as you go. That's what I think it is, and it gives a film, for me, my films, a lived-in, unfolding realism, because we're really solving the problems as we go along. But there is extreme rigidity going in and coming out. That's the point. Does that answer your question?
It does, actually.
For the purpose of authenticity, you ended up using a lot of genuine soldiers in the film. Could you talk a little bit about what they brought to the table, and perhaps ways in which they influenced decisions that you ultimately made?
Well, I was always very clear that we were trying to build a thriller. A film that would have broad appeal to an audience. Yeah, essentially the audience that had come to the Bourne films. Because it's a long... I'm trying to get to your answer, so you understand my thought process. For me, it was impossible not to make the Bourne films I'm talking about, and not be very, very aware that there was a big audience out there who really enjoyed the particular sort of mix of elements that Matt and I put, that came together for those films. In other words, a character with a strong moral agenda, a lot of high energy, intense action that was incredibly detailed, I think, but very, very fast. Strong contemporary sort of real world type settings, and also a good measure of kind of smartness, intelligence, if you like. So you kind of get the big high octane foot on the pedal type of feel, but it's smart and urgent and contemporary and all of that. And that, I think, was quite a fresh mix in a familiar genre. And that's often the skill. If you're working in commercial cinema where you're trying to attract a broad audience, you've got to be within genres that your audience understand, but testing them and pushing the envelope, pushing the boundaries a bit. When you get it right, the audience go, oh, that's new, fantastic, I love it. But it's still sustained by the familiarity of the genre, Okay, so... Now, the other thing is, it was impossible not to be trying to stick a Bourne film very close to a kind of real world, which is what we were trying to do all the time, make it feel like it was kind of ripped out of the headlines, and not be aware that this huge kind of, the world's kind of, what's out there is incredibly dramatic, right? So clearly somewhere what we were distilling in a Bourne film by way of a sort of paranoia and a mistrust and all that stuff, the kind of conspiracy thriller, if you like, which is what a Bourne film is, was feeling very, very fitting and exciting to that audience, right? Well, obviously that had to have something to do, it seemed to me. I mean, I remember sitting with you guys when we did Ultimatum, it had to somewhere be to do with the fact that the world seemed very turbulent, and the movies sort of reflect that, and they distill it and reflect it back as a kind of paranoid conspiracy thriller, and the audience go, yeah, that feels like off now, right? So you come to this film and you go, well, let's see if we can take one step further into the real world and see if we can build a conspiracy thriller there that's got the same high energy and high octane and, focused, detailed storytelling and smartness and a moral, noble hero with a moral agenda and all that stuff. Not a Bourne film, but with those same elements and instincts that we bring to the table as a partnership, and invite that audience, which after all is the audience that's, it's a young audience, say, does that work for you? Is that, you know, does that feel real? Does that feel bang, you know, that excitement of the new? Is that a way of serving up a conspiracy action thriller, which is a classic genre, if you like, but reviving it and making it feel fresh and new and interesting and original, you know, but still maintaining its broad appeal? So that's kind of where we started from. Okay, so once you get into the shooting of it, you're saying, well, this is a piece, you know, it is those things, and it is about, you know, Matt and Brendan and Amy and Khaled and all, you know, the story of the film. It's kind of a really great story and drive on and blah, 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 blah. But within that, we can support the reality of their performances by, say, getting a load of real guys. Because in the end, rather than cast a load of actors to play soldiers, it's much better to get soldiers to act, because in the end, they know, you know, you don't then have to explain to them, well, here's in the story, Miller has to hit this house and come narrowly face to face with the Jack of Clubs. Now, you could spend a lot of time finding a lot of actors who can perform that, but in a way, you're really trying to make them behave like soldiers. Well, why not just get soldiers? It's easier. I mean, and just say, okay, that's, you've been told that's the house, and let's go. And so you end up with Matt, some actors with military experience, like Jerry DeSalle, who's his number two, you know, who are sort of both in a sense, and then a bedrock of soldiers, and that just made it, I think, much, much, much better for Matt. I mean, you'd have to ask him, but I think it made him just sit in the part and be very real and, you know, gave the whole thing that sort of intensity and energy. It's the thinking, anyway. Okay.
And we found your jacket.
Oh, cool.
Can you talk a little bit about what you saw specifically in each of the actors that you cast for their parts? What made them stand out for you?
Well, Matt, because he's pretty good. and the world's greatest movie star. Brendan, because I wanted a guy who felt like he'd been in the Middle East a long time and seen it all, and you know, I was quite interested in the idea of the CIA guy being a good guy, you know. That felt to me quite original. So you need an actor who sort of could convey integrity, but within a sort of rough-hewn, pragmatic worldview, you know. So I think he does that very well. Khaled, because Freddie was such a kind of very difficult character, you know, a guy with one leg, you know, it'd be very easy for that character not to really feel like a real person with a real point of view that you really bought into. And he's just one of the great, you know, the great young British actors. Amy, because same reason, you know, I wanted a journalist, but I just wanted the journalist to feel very real world and, you know, caught up in her own problem. You know, she's been given this information, and now of course she's coming to check it because it's not proving, you know, it's not, the stuff's not been found, and when she asks the question she gets fobbed off, and of course then she hits Miller and she has to confess to what's happening. So there was a sort of, you know, a kind of simplicity and an yeah, it wasn't a big statement, it was just very real, looked like a working reporter, you know. Who's that leave? Oh, Greg, of course, because, you know, casting against type, I thought he makes an absolutely superb bad guy, you know. And what's lovely about his performance, I think, is because you can sort of see that he's uncomfortable with it all. He really gives it a sense of misplaced idealism, which I think is at the heart of all of that stuff. You know, very few people do bad things because they're bad. They generally do bad things because they think they're the right thing to do, but they're misplaced, you know, and I think you get a strong sense of that from him. And Jason, because he wears the best moustache in recent history. And he's my old mate, so...
I'm going to ask the question that every fan out there of the Bourne franchise wants to know.
Yep.
Are you Are you definitely not doing another one? What could you give people the status of what's up with that?
What happened was that I just felt I love the Bourne franchise, number one, and I owe it a great deal. And I gave my all on the two films that I made. But when I was honest with myself in the last autumn, and I was sort of starting to get going on other things, you just come to a point where you realise you've done it. You don't have anything more to contribute to a franchise that needs to continue, obviously. And in order to continue, a franchise needs to be rebooted and re-energized by new perspectives. And I just felt that I'd done it. And there's nothing unnatural about that. To make a film, it's 18 months of your life, it's 7 days a week, it's 20 hours a day. You've got to have real, and there were just too many other things that I was interested in. I felt I'd had a wonderful, wonderful time. I loved it, and I want it to continue, and I hope it did. So in the end, contrary to the reports, there was never an argument with the studio of any kind at all. I did spend some time thinking that I might, and sort of getting myself to a place where what would it be? And that was really, it's only when you do that that you actually find, I've sort of gone here, I'm on to other things.
Does this mean?
So I explained to them, we had a very nice discussion, they were completely understanding, and I said, listen, we'll make some other moves. They said, excellent.
So this is like, we can put the nail, this is official, you are definitely not doing another one.
I'm doing some other things. Yeah.
Which is the follow-up of what are you thinking about for other projects?
God, blimey, don't know. Haven't got anything definite yet, but I'm enjoying reviving, doing some... those four films...
Like 8 years?
It's, it's Supremacy... Actually, six.
Sure,
Supremacy... What are we now? 2009?
Yeah, 2010.
What year? 2006. That's all right. Supremacy 93, Ultimatum, Green Zone. And I think this was also part of my sort of feeling, although I didn't realise it then, but you sort of sit down and go, actually, it's like the end of a chapter. They're all four films that are really about this decade, and they're all sort of interlinked in a funny kind of way, even though some of them are quite different to the others. But they're all sort of really about those years and that world, and that sort of a film, the big high octane action movie type of thing. So I just thought, okay, I need to find some new tricks to this old dog. Well, not so old, but you know what I'm saying. So you kind of go, actually, I need to do some different things and engage with some new material. I'd like to do something that's a bit more with boys and girls and men and women and love and
pure comedy.
All
pure
that good stuff.
Comedy. There you go.
Yeah, well, maybe. You never know. I'd like to do a family film. I'll still make... I want to do... Matt and I want to do some things that are... continue our partnership. We'll certainly be doing that. And it's just time to move on. That's what happens.
All right.
Listen, you'd be the first to say if I came back and did a bad one, you'd go... Should have got somebody else.
I know you have to walk out of the room, but what can people expect with all the extra stuff you might have shot on the DVD/Blu-ray? Is there anything that you might be able to... Do you know what might go
on?
No,
there's nothing. I only shoot... Take the boards off and that's the movie. No, I'm joking. They're actually very interesting because there's a couple of very interesting scenes that will illustrate that point you were asking, where you can see where we tried something initially to try and unfold the story. And you can see in the deleted scene, the one particular scene I'm thinking of, where we were trying something to get to the place that we actually got to, but we got to it by another scene. And it's always interesting, I think, when you look at that, because you see, that's what I'm talking about, where you... The key thing is you've got to have a sense of where you're aiming for. What, it's the difference between a map and taking the journey. The screenplay is your map. The more detailed it is, the more you can reconnoitre what your road actually is going to be, the better it is. But it's not the journey itself, you know. And Brian and I, yeah, Brian's a fantastic, he's, you know, one of my best friends, and he was with this film from, with the exception of the strike bit in the middle, from first day to the day we finished the cut and put this thing to bed. Because that's what I'm saying, writing, performing, editing is something that should start, you start with your writing and you gather all three pieces of the process, and you need to keep all three pieces of the process as firmly in alignment as you possibly can. And then the shooting drops away and you're left with the writing and the cutting to the literally the last moment. Because you're never stopping in the cutting room. I'd be saying to Brian, what about if we did this, this and this? And, you know, and you might say, oh, what about if we did this, this and this? You know, and then Chris and I would try to... And it's a... That's why... That's the filmmaking process that I have recognised. And I think in some ways for all directors, it's some version of that where it's a collaborative conversation. You know, and rather like a piece of music, instruments come in and instruments fall away. And one of the skills of being a director is to say, well, look, we don't need the trumpets now, but I need to sit with the brass and get that, or the strings or whatever, and get that bit right. And you, but you're moving forward to the end.
Cool.
Brilliant.
Thanks,
thank you.
No worries. Thank you.